We are talking once again with Jav Parrish and Maria Tomchik, local writers and activists, here to give us a wrap-up of this past week's news. Good afternoon to you both.
Good afternoon.
Okay, so starting out with local and the Seattle City Council.
Yeah, the City Council this week overrode the mayor's veto of the 2020 revised budget, which surprised some people, did not surprise me, because I took a look at the mayor's compromise that she had proposed, the compromise that she worked out with Lorena Gonzalez over the course of about 2 to 3 weeks between when she overrode the City Council's budget and when they came back from recess. And her compromise budget contained almost none of the substantial changes that the City Council had made. For example, it included no cuts to the Seattle Police Department, none whatsoever that I could see, no loan to pay for human services programs, no money for participatory budgeting, and only about one third of the money that the council had set aside for community-based public safety. So $1 million instead of the $3 million that the City Council had wanted to spend. It had, and in addition, there were no cuts to the navigation team other than letting two vacant positions remain unfilled. So the City Council really had no choice but to vote by 7-2 to override Mayor Durkin's veto. Peterson and Juarez, predictably, were the two no votes. And even
we should point out that they were also the no votes for the original council
bill.
Budget.
Yeah.
So every council member who voted for their original budget changes voted to override the veto.
Yeah. And even council member Gonzalez, who spent the last some weeks trying to negotiate that compromise package with Mayor Durkin. She said on Monday before the vote that she preferred to vote to overturn Durkin's veto instead of supporting the compromise bill. So even she really disliked that compromise bill. Unfortunately, the City Council, although we now have a balanced budget, the City Council can't force the mayor to actually spend the money the way they've allocated it, right? Their cuts, however, should remain in force, including the cuts that they made to the navigation team, cutting all the police personnel from the navigation team and cutting 100 officer positions from the Seattle Police Department. Most of those cuts, of course, would come through attrition and retirement and cuts to public relations officers, not to officers on the street.
Yeah, we should point out that Durkin has a history of taking money that she doesn't want to spend, that the council passed, and reallocating it to her favorite programs. And so far, there's been nothing to stop her from doing that, even though, you know, on the face of it, that should be illegal. But apparently it's not.
Yeah. Durkin, of course, will now release her proposed budget for 2021 this coming Tuesday. Because of COVID-19, it's going to be a one-year budget instead of the typical two-year budget. The City Council then will discuss the budget and make changes throughout October and into November, and they typically take a final vote on the budget package just before Thanksgiving. Now, until that time, most of the other committee meetings are either canceled or they're put on hold while the full council works on the budget.
Yeah, there'll be a bunch of public hearings on those budget proposals also.
As part of that, yeah. And because it's virtual, people don't have to go down to City Hall to participate in those hearings. You can watch them online, which is great for folks who have easy access to a computer, not so great for folks who don't. Of course, we'll see during those hearings how many of the ideas that the City Council discussed in August will become fleshed out in the 2021 budget, including bigger cuts to the Seattle Police Department, setting up a new civilian-led 911 public safety unit, which was one of the bills that was passed this August, funding for new and existing programs to divert low-level offenders and youth from jail. That's a big part of what the City Council said they wanted to fund instead of the police department. and whether they can allocate money for new programs to help communities of color, another piece of that puzzle, and funding to address homelessness and the housing crisis. And of course, there will still be a need for more COVID-19 related funding for everything from programs to help the unemployed to money for COVID-19 testing and contact tracing. And that money, which the city might have in the past counted on Congress, the federal government, to provide, has not been forthcoming. You know, once it ran out. So the city council is going to probably have to dig deep and find it in the city budget next year.
Now, and there's also going to be cuts in state funding, almost certainly. So they're going to have to deal with that as well.
Yeah. Now, of course, the good news is that our local economy has done better than the national economy. So tax revenue may not be as low as initially feared. And the city council will get at least one revenue projection while they're working on the budget where the city economists come in and tell them, hey, you know, revenue projections are actually expected to be this for 2021, not what we initially gave the mayor when she did her budget. So that could be a bit of good news during the budget process. But, you know, it's still going to be pretty hard for the city council to find money for 100% of what they want to do. Even if the revenue projections turn out to be better than expected, they're still not going to be that much better.
Would you expect changes in the foreseeable future then in terms of regulating what our mayor does for the budget? I mean, right now it's clear that the mayor apparently doesn't have to spend the money on the items selected. And from based on what you had just said, it also appears that not only not spend it, but redirect it towards other things. So it seems like somebody would be pushing to let's change the laws on that.
Yeah, I don't know. We will have to see. Of course, there's always the mayor's reelection campaign next year.
Yeah, you know? And somebody's got to run against her too, and we don't know who that's going to be yet.
Typically, in an election year, you see a person who's running for reelection try to do their best to please who they view as their main constituents. So it'll be interesting to see who that is in Jenny Durkin's mind.
I think I know
who it is, but it'll be interesting to see who she and her political consultants think that is.
And put on the brochures.
And of course, I would love to see some really good progressive candidate go up against her, one or maybe two
candidates. And somebody who can run a viable campaign also.
Yeah.
Because it will take a lot of money to defeat her. So, you know, the sooner that person can start, the better.
Yeah, I don't know how much money it would take to defeat her. It would take a lot of work, for sure, one or the other. So if you don't want to put in a ton of work, it's going to take a lot of money. If you don't have a lot of money, it would take a lot of work. So it'd be interesting to see who steps forward and is able to do that.
Yeah, that will be.
Yep.
All right. Anything else on city council? Council actions. Otherwise, move on to SPD related news.
Yeah, some news related to the Seattle Police Department. First off, I want to talk about something that happened a couple of weeks ago when I wasn't able to do the show. Merrick Bob's resignation.
I talked about that the last couple of weeks. So go for it.
Yeah, he announced his resignation. When he did. Initially, he said it's time for a change. That was what he said initially. And he implied that in the 7 years that he'd been the court monitor, that the Seattle Police Department had made great progress and, you know, he could rest on his laurels, right? But in a letter he sent to the Seattle Times, he took a very different tone, saying that the Seattle Police Department's response to protests this summer had been demoralizing to him. And that he thought the SPD had backslid considerably and that their use of force against protesters had cost the department goodwill with the public. And then this week, Merrick Bob released a final report saying that the Seattle Police Department should ban the use of tear gas altogether, rewrite its crowd control policies, train its officers how to properly use other crowd control weapons to minimize injuries to demonstrators, and remind its officers that street demonstrations are a legally protected form of free speech, and that police should be on the streets to protect protesters' free speech rights, not to brutalize them. He also condemned the way the Seattle Police Department had treated journalists and medics during this summer's protests. He pointed out that the SPD lacks, quote unquote, seasoned and well-trained commanders who can lead when it comes to crowd control. So essentially he's saying that the deficiency in the department goes right up through the ranks to the top when it comes to crowd control. He noted that the one deputy chief who had significant crowd control experience is now retired, and that SPD management hadn't had the foresight to train or hire anyone to replace him. So that's a direct critique of top management at the Seattle Police Department, including Carmen Best. Seems to be a real indictment of former Chief Carmen Best's management, or in this case, mismanagement of the department. And it's true that Merrick Bob is on record as saying that he thinks the city needs to hire someone from outside the department as the new chief. And Carmen Best was definitely, she rose through the ranks in the Seattle Police Department. Now, I would go further and say that it should be somebody with operational experience, not another public relations officer who can shake hands and smile for the camera, but who can't run the department effectively. And I think that's what we had with Carmen Best, and what we're having right now with Adrian Diaz, who himself spent most of his time, not, I think probably even less time on the streets than Carmen Best did, and has spent most of his time doing kind of PR work and work with youths and schools and so forth. Now, Judge James Robart has appointed a new monitor, court monitor, for the Seattle Police Department. That man is Dr. Antonio Oftili. Oftili is executive director of the Leadership for a Networked World, and that seems to be part of Harvard University's Technology and Entrepreneurship Center, which is a networking pipeline for Harvard students and graduates into government and private businesses, although that door seems to sometimes swing the other way as well. Now, Oftili started out as an instructor for private businesses. An instructor for executive management training classes. He has a Bachelor's of Science in Management and Ethics from Crown College in Minnesota. So he comes from this around the same area that George Floyd did. He has a Master's of Public Administration with a Business and Government Policy concentration from Harvard University, and a PhD in Law and Policy from Northeastern University, where he studied constitutional and administrative law. He also served on the Commission on the Future of Policing in Ireland under Kathleen O'Toole, so he's very familiar with her management style. And he has said in his comments to the Seattle Times and to other media outlets that he feels the Seattle Police Department still has good people in them who worked with Kathleen O'Toole, and he wants to bring those good people forward. And that too is, an indictment of Carmen Best's leadership and of her leadership team, her management team. So we'll see how things go under Oftili, and whether or not he can have more of an impact on what the Seattle Police Department is doing right now with their horrendous crowd control of the summer's demonstrations, you know, where Merrick Bob couldn't actually affect any kind of change in those policies.
Although I think over the 7 years, Bob did a reasonably good job. It's just that the cultural rot within SPD really is top to bottom. And it has been for a long time. And that was the problem with Carmen Best. She was a product of that system. And, she was so institutionally wed to that culture that she really couldn't affect change in it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I would agree with that. And, that kind of change takes time, and it takes a lot of effort, and it takes sustained effort. And, the city of Seattle hasn't put in that sustained effort, really.
No.
Yeah. So the other thing I want to talk about, too, in regards to SPD news is this week the Office of Police Accountability released its findings in the first five cases of complaints brought by demonstrators over police tactics at this summer's protests that followed in the wake of George Floyd's killing in late May. Excuse me. The OPA has received more than 30,000 complaints, which it has consolidated into about 100 cases. The OPA has a 120-day time limit for investigating and ruling on complaints. So this first batch of cases are the ones that occurred on May 30th and in the first week of June when the protests started.
And we should point out that that 120-day limit is part of the SPD contract. So yeah. that needs to be looked at when, God help us, Mayor Durkan is negotiating a new contract with SPOG, which is coming up in next year. And should be underway now.
Yeah, I think the 120-day limit is to push the OPA into action so that complaints don't just sit on their desk forever. I don't think that is necessarily a bad thing. But these first cases, remember, they're not all of the cases that arose on May 30th and the first week of June. They're just the easy ones, the ones that were easy and quick that they could clear. But there will be more rulings released each week, every week, until the OPA clears its backlogs of these complaints.
And OPA does not have subpoena power. So they have to go buy, you know, documents from within SPD. They can't question them. And they don't have the staff to process 30,000 complaints. They may
Which
not
is
have
why they, that's why they consolidated them as much as they could. Now, of the five cases they released this week, three were ruled not sustained for various reasons, mostly because it was a he said, she said kind of situation where there was no video to back up the complaint, which makes you wonder, okay, in that situation, why wasn't the officer's body camera turned on?
Okay. Yeah. And there were an amazing number of cameras at those protests. So, you know, how hard did they look for online archives?
Yeah. And in some cases, a key witness or the victim refused to be interviewed by the OPA investigators, who I have to point out may have been Seattle police officers. Now, the OPA itself has two civilian investigators and nine Seattle police officers who conduct investigations. So it's highly likely that people who had been brutalized or injured by the police would have had to have been interviewed by the police in order to have their complaint taken. And I think that is a huge problem with the OPA as well. Now, of those three cases that were not sustained, one of them involved the pepper spraying of a young boy. That incident drew the most complaints of any to the OPA. Police body cam video showed that the officer who fired the pepper spray was trying to actually mace a female protester who ducked, and the pepper spray then hit the boy and his father who were standing behind her. The OPA, of course, didn't ask the question of whether deploying pepper spray into a crowd was reckless. They merely ruled that the boy was not intentionally targeted, therefore it was not sustained. So it's okay to mace a young child at a protest as long as you didn't intend to mace him.
That reminds me a lot of the Breonna Taylor ruling, which we'll get to in a little bit, where, you know, it's okay to shoot somebody, but the problem is missing.
Yeah, right. Now, a fourth case that was only partially sustained involved video of Seattle Police Department officers restraining two demonstrators on the ground. One officer clearly has his knee on the neck of one of the protesters, and you can hear people in the background yelling at him to move his knee off the man's neck. The other officer hears the yelling, and he pushes the first officer's knee off the man's neck. The OPA only partially sustained this complaint, saying that, yes, it's against SPD policy for an officer to put his knee on a suspect's neck. But the officer testified that he didn't think he'd had his knee on the person's neck, so it wasn't intentional. Again, that question of intentionality.
What body part did he think he had it on?
He thought it was the upper back, you know. And his partner thought at first it was on the person's head, which I have to say is also not safe for you to put a lot of pressure on someone's head when it's turned to the side. You can severely damage their neck. But But because he didn't intend to put his knee on the person's neck and that he didn't think he had actually restricted the person's airway, then it was only partially sustained. Now, the final case
that reminds me, by the way, we also had an SPD incident this week with protesters where a bicycle cop literally ran his bicycle over the head of a protester who was injured and on the ground.
Yeah, and the video that's getting shared widely is Joey Weiser's video, and it doesn't really
No, it's not. It's not Joey Weiser. It's CJ.
It's CJ. Okay, good, because that's the one that does fully show it, and it is sickening to watch. So there's a couple videos out there, and some people who see Joey's video, they say, "Oh, it wasn't that bad," because Joey didn't capture it fully. CJ captured it fully, and it is pretty bad. Now, the only case that was fully sustained of the five cases that were released was an unidentified officer saying, quote, "I have a hard-on for this shit, and if they cross the line, I will hit them," end quote. Now, this case was sustained because there was cell phone video that captured it, and the officer involved admitted that he had said that, but that he was just quoting the movie Top Gun. But
that makes it much better.
Well, that makes it so much better, yeah. But the OPA found this to be unprofessional, so they sustained a charge that he acted unprofessionally. And that's it. And those were the first five cases they released. Only one was fully sustained of an officer saying something that was unprofessional. And
five down, 90 some to go.
Yeah, and it does not seem like protesters at this point are going to get a whole lot of justice from the OPA, and that the OPA doesn't seem to provide a whole lot of recourse for folks with complaints. But it's interesting because the OPA was meant to be the place where suspects, people of color, for example, would have to go if they had sustained injuries or if they had had their rights violated by a police officer. And I think it's privileged white kids now who are beginning to see how the OPA has not well served communities of color in that role.
And that's been true for at least a decade.
It's been true for a while. Yeah. So that's it. There was a lawsuit filed yesterday in King County Superior Court against the City of Seattle and Washington State for failing to protect protesters from drivers, as the Seattle Police Department and the Washington State Patrol used to do in the past. And I remember when they did actually used to block traffic for demonstrations on a regular basis, but that they just do not do that anymore.
I sure hope Diaz Love is part of that suit.
Yes, she is. Plaintiffs in the case include Summer Taylor's family and Daniel Gregory, who stopped a man from driving his SUV into a large group of demonstrators on Capitol Hill in June and was shot in the arm by that same man. Summer Taylor, I'll remind folks, was killed when a man drove his car down an open exit ramp onto I-5, did a 180-degree turn on the freeway, wove his car through a barrier of parked cars, and then plowed at full speed into a group of protesters, mortally injuring Taylor and severely injuring Diaz Love. In addition...
Who, by the way, was back at the protest this week in a wheelchair. So, good for her.
Wow. Yeah. In addition, the lawsuit alleges In addition, the lawsuit alleges that the SPD has assaulted demonstrators and violated their free speech rights and their right to assembly under the U.S. Constitution, which Merrick Bob appears to agree with. Once again, more sickening video this week with a cop rolling his bicycle over the head of a protester who was laying injured on the ground.
And he has been suspended with pay.
Suspended with pay. Yeah, it really gives the appearance that the Seattle police are completely out of control, that the mayor is doing nothing about it. The interim police chief, Adrian Diaz, is doing nothing about it. And, of course, the city council doesn't have the authority to do very much about it other than to cut their budget, which they're working hard to try to do. But in the next couple of weeks, we should be hearing soon from Judge James Robart about the council's ban on crowd control weapons, and then we'll see if he weighs in on the Seattle Police Department's performance at the protests this summer.
And I would expect that there are going to be massive protests over the next couple of months, depending on the election results and what Trump does about it, which we'll get to in a minute. So it's important now to lay the groundwork for challenging how SPD does crowd control, because they're going to have to be doing a lot more of that, I think. And,
I'm guessing there'll be a whole lot more, particularly vulnerable people on the street, people with kids, for example, elderly people turning out if there are issues with the election. I expect that there will be people on the street who SPD could very not injure and be able to recover from those injuries, but potentially people that they would kill with crowd control weapons.
Yeah.
So.
Well, that's cheerful.
I know, that's a very cheerful way to.
So can we talk about the county council budget?
King County Executive released his budget for 2021 and 2022. The centerpiece of Dow Constantine's budget is a new 0.1% sales tax increase to fund housing for chronically homeless people. It would raise an estimated $400 million, enough to house about 2,000 people, through the purchase and renovation of distressed properties like old hotels, motels, nursing homes, and other facilities. But the actual need is about three times higher than that in unincorporated King County, and much, much higher than that if you include Seattle.
And I would expect that's going to be highly controversial, given that we're going to be, going into a depression. And sales tax, I'm sorry, it's a very regressive tax.
It is.
So it's going to hurt the people who can least afford it.
Yeah, and, Washington State has the fourth highest average state and local sales tax rate in the nation, behind only Tennessee, Louisiana, and Arkansas, whose rates are just slightly higher than ours. And as Josh said, it's an extremely regressive tax.
And that doesn't count the sales tax in King County and Seattle, which is even higher than the state average.
Yeah, much higher than the state average. In fact, I think Seattle has maybe the fourth or fifth highest sales tax for any large city in the nation. I think only Chicago and a couple of California cities have very wealthy California cities have higher sales tax rates. But of course, raising the sales tax would require approval from the state legislature. Washington State already, Washington State already has issues with trying to plug their budget. So allowing a state and local government to raise the sales tax in order to do that may be stepping on the state's toes in terms of what they can do to plug the state budget. We'll have to see. Now, that was the only revenue booster in Dow Constantine's budget, which also features a plan to cut 450 jobs. Most of those will be cut through attrition and retirements, but at least 50 people are going to have to be laid off in order to meet that goal. About 200 of those job losses will be in Metro Transit. So many drivers who were furloughed because of COVID-19 are probably not going to be called back into work, is my guess, even though Metro will begin collecting fares again on October 1st. Fortunately, they have a plan to suspend fare enforcement through the end of this year, although Metro plans to bring it back in 2021 and reimagine it. And I have to say that I can't imagine a good version of fare enforcement. But at least they've decided to suspend it for the rest of this year. Much of the county's spending on COVID-19 relief has also run out. So that money, which originally came from the federal government, has not been renewed by Congress. Congress has not passed a second relief bill. So Dow Constantine's budget would pull about $4.2 million from the county's rainy day fund in January if no more federal money is approved by then to cover COVID-19 spending. Constantine also announced new funding to help people clear their marijuana convictions. The funding would come from $4.6 million in marijuana tax revenues that used to go to the King County Sheriff's Office. But now, even though initially that looks like a cut to funding for the sheriff's office, it actually is not, because those are funds that the sheriff's office had already identified as unspent money in their budget that could be reallocated elsewhere in the county budget. So that's really not a cut for the sheriff's office. In addition, Constantine wants to provide $6.2 million over 2 years for a diversion program called Restorative Community Pathways, funded through cuts to the King County Superior Court, the Department of Public Defense, and the King County Prosecutor's Office. In other words, cuts to the court system, but not to the police, not to the sheriff's department. And while we might expect that diversion programs would eventually lead to fewer people cycling through the court system, that change isn't immediate. And in addition, diversion programs often work in tandem with judges and prosecutors to try to keep people out of jail. So cutting funding for courts up front doesn't really make sense right away. So we'll just see how this, how the county council deals with that, and whether or not they agree to allocate the full $6.2 million, or whether they decide to pull that from somewhere else in the budget. Now, his budget would also cut $1.9 million in funding for the county jail, with most of that money going toward diversion programs for low-level first-time offenders and youth. So that's also good news, he foresees that that cut can be made because these diversion programs will mean that that the county jail will just need to will just eventually have fewer and fewer people in it. Therefore, they can start closing it off floor by floor.
So there was a lot of fanfare, I believe, in August. God, that was only last month. Wow. About a 5-year plan to phase out the youth jail.
Yeah.
And I'm wondering how this budget fits into that agreement.
I think that's been going on for a while. And so this budget, I didn't really look into that line item in particular, so I can't answer that question directly. But my guess is because that's been going on for a while that Constantine wrote the budget with the idea that it would, he would continue phasing out youth incarceration. He's talked in the past. He talked in August with protesters, saying that this has been an ongoing strategy to try to divert youth from the jail and to slowly whittle down the numbers of youth who are incarcerated there and eventually close the jail. And my guess is that he's still on that same path.
Okay.
Mm-hmm.
All right. Anything else on the budget?
Nope.
Okay, that takes us then
on. I should say that seeing job cuts and seeing money come out of some very basic services that the county provides, like Metro Transit, for example, I think that's a preview of what we're going to see with the city budget hearings coming up, that there's going to be a hole. There's going to be a big hole in the budget in terms of revenue.
Yeah.
And so
and a lot of the cuts are going to hurt. Yeah,
they're going to be cuts that hurt. Yeah.
Yeah, and they've got tough choices to make, for sure.
They do.
Yeah. Choices that we'll all be living with.
Yep.
Or not. All right, let's move on to national and developments revolving around Ruth Bader Ginsburg's passing.
Yeah, Jeff, you want to take that one?
Yeah, sure. Talked the last couple of weeks about Ruth Bader Ginsburg's passing, and she lied in state, the first woman to do so at the Capitol this week. And as soon as that was done, literally within a couple of hours, Donald Trump last night named his replacement. As expected, it was a woman named Amy Coney Barrett, who's 48 years old. She is a former clerk and protege of Antonin Scalia, which tells you something where she's coming from. And she is basically the ideal candidate of the Federalist Society. She is to Ruth Bader Ginsburg. She's basically the Ginsburg's polar opposite. She's to Ginsburg what Clarence Thomas was to Thurgood Marshall, and we know how that worked out. And the Senate and Majority Leader Mitch McConnell has already said that they fully intend to get her seated on the Supreme Court before Election Day. And the reason for that, of course, is tied into Donald Trump's suddenly saying, after he met with Coney Barrett last weekend, he's suddenly starting to talk about, well, I think the election is going to go to the Supreme Court. I don't think the ballots can be counted, and we really need 9 justices for that. So it makes you think that he got an assurance from Coney Barrett of how she would vote in that kind of circumstance. when they met privately last weekend. Now, Coney Barrett joins John Roberts and Brett Kavanaugh. All three of them worked on George W. Bush's legal team trying to stop votes from being counted in Florida in 2000. So that tells you where that's coming from. The other things that she's going to be primarily questioned on, I think, during her confirmation hearings are, number one, that she has said in the past recently that the Affordable Care Act, which is literally going to be heard by the Supreme Court, that lawsuit in early November, that it's unconstitutional. So she will almost certainly be a vote for dismantling the ACA, which would literally deprive at least 100 million Americans with pre-existing conditions alone of health insurance in the middle of a pandemic. That's one issue. The other issue, of course, is abortion. She is not only fervently Catholic, but she belongs to a sort of an offshoot of Catholicism that's it's kind of a Pentecostal version of it called People of Praise, that believes that women should be subjugated to men and various other reactionary things. She was questioned on that when she was named a district court judge in 2017. And she has a reputation at Notre Dame, where she is on the faculty, of being very fervently religious, and since she's gone on the Supreme on the district court, of basing rulings on her religious beliefs. She's considered an originalist, but she is also very pro-corporate. She is somewhat libertarian in that she thinks corporations should do whatever they want, but she is decidedly not corporate in terms of individual libertarian in terms of individual liberties. She's not sympathetic at all, for example, to the rights of oppressed communities or people who have been aggrieved by corporate misbehavior. You can probably kiss environmental regulations goodbye with her, banking regulations, et cetera, et cetera. She is, in other words, likely to be a problem on the Supreme Court for at least 30 years. She's 48 years old.
Can I talk a little bit about her background?
Oh,
I'm
sure.
Always,
go for it.
I'm always really curious about what kind of a woman would be anti-abortion, right? So I started to read a little bit about Amy Coney Barrett's background, and what strikes me is she just comes from an overwhelmingly privileged white background. Her father was a corporate lawyer for Shell Oil. Amy Coney Barrett went to a private Catholic girls' school, and after she graduated from that, she went to a private four-year college. She graduated from there, went to went into Notre Dame Law School, graduated at the top of her class, so she's hardworking, sure, but it's as if she's always had this, you know, and right out of law school, she went to clerk for a U.S. Appeals Court judge for 2 years, then immediately clerked 1 year at the Supreme Court for Justice Antonin Scalia. And after she left that, she went into a boutique private law firm in Washington, D.C. that represented Richard Nixon, Ted Kennedy, and had a reputation for representing executives who were accused of white-collar crimes. So, yes, very pro-corporate. It's as if she was born into privilege and has always had a menu of things that she could choose from in her life. So I really feel, I look at her and it's like, okay, naturally this is the kind of woman who would be against providing any kind of outs for a young girl born into poverty who has to decide whether or not to stay in high school, graduate from high school, or drop out and have a baby. You know, I mean,
yeah.
She cannot.
And people like this, even if abortion is banned, they will have options for terminating a pregnancy.
Oh,
it's well, horrible, will not.
She actually has a disabled child that she had the opportunity to, she knew when she was carrying that child that he would be born disabled, and she chose to have that child anyway. But she's a woman who has always had money, and I'm sure has a nanny and a housekeeper, and, you know, she's always had a menu of options to choose from. She does not understand, does not come from a background of foreclosed options, you know, of having only one path that you can go down, or being limited and your only out is, okay, I need to have an abortion, otherwise my life is ruined. She cannot comprehend that. And to take someone like Justice Ginsburg, who always had to struggle in order to be a woman working in law, and replace her with a woman like this, who is so deeply privileged and in many ways sheltered from the kinds of struggles that average Americans have to go through, and particularly women and women of color in this country, that just seems like an absolute insult and a slap in the face to what Justice Ginsburg was.
And again, the reason I compared the Coney Barrett nomination to Clarence Thomas's nomination is because Thomas was replacing Thurgood Marshall, who was a civil rights pioneer.
Yes.
Similarly, Ginsburg was a pioneer for women's rights, and she is being replaced by a nominee who is completely tone deaf and as you say, sheltered and not comprehend what
the women's rights struggle is about, really, because for her there have always been options, and they've always been the best options. After she went to work for this boutique law firm, she didn't have a whole lot of trial court experience there, because after 2 or 3 years, the firm closed down, and then she decided, I'll just teach. She went to George Washington University, didn't like it there, and then chose to go to her alma mater, Notre Dame Law, and she taught there for something like 15 years before she was plucked by Donald Trump to serve on as a circuit judge on the U.S. Court of Appeals. So
and
she
with,
always
as,
had these doors
as,
opened for her.
Yeah, as with many Trump nominees, she has probably the least actual courtroom experience of any nominee to the Supreme Court.
Yeah. So this is how you get a woman who can be anti-abortion, who can support someone like Donald Trump, who can be can work in these high-level jobs but still not comprehend the need for women's rights or civil rights, is you find someone like this who is a white, highly privileged, always been catered to person who has no concept of the struggle of ordinary people. And I think that just deeply makes her deeply unqualified. Even though she's a very intelligent person, she's very hardworking. I don't agree that she always brings her religion into her decisions. I think she does look at precedent when she makes decisions. I think that she is definitely influenced by her religion, though. But I just feel like it's her privileged background that makes her completely unqualified to sit on the highest court.
Yeah. And, you know, as much as Senate Democrats are saying they're going to try and stall and they're going to try and oppose her, they really don't have many options procedurally for slowing this down, unfortunately. It is a consequence of who is voted into the presidency. And as we've seen, there are a lot of consequences to having Trump in office.
Trump does have every right to appoint a replacement for Ginsburg. If he were a person with ethics and a person who respected other people, you know, and respected the wishes of other people, he probably wouldn't appoint someone. But, you know, he's not that person. So
no. And as you say, you know, he's talking about. Well, the quote that made the rounds this week that, there won't be a transition. There will just be a continuation. If he was so confident that there would be a continuation, he'd be okay waiting, but he sees the Supreme Court as necessary to his reelection, which tells you a lot about how he's approaching this election.
Yeah.
He knows he's behind in the polls. He knows he's probably not going to win in terms of absolute votes. But between the various ways that he's trying to cheat and suppress the vote and all the rest of it, and he's going to probably try and get a lot of votes thrown out.
It's just another way for him to cheat, essentially, yeah.
All right. Anything else on that?
Nope.
All right. Moving on, the Breonna Taylor decision came down this week.
Yeah, and a bunch of things came down around the racial justice movement. The first thing that happened on Monday was New York City and Portland and Seattle were formally named anarchist jurisdictions by the Department of Justice and William Barr memo that purported to offer legal justification for withholding federal funds from those three cities. Now, that that actual document. It was a political document. It was not a legal document. Anarchist jurisdictions was actually never defined. It was a phrase first used earlier this month in a memo from Donald Trump, asking the Justice Department to explore, a justification for withholding federal funds. And this was the justification. There was nothing that defined anarchist jurisdiction, and what made those three cities, for example, different from other cities that have had violent protests, such as Minneapolis, Philadelphia, Los Angeles, etc., all of which are cities with Democratic governors and Democratic mayors. Kenosha, there's a whole bunch of them that they could have named, but they named these three probably because Fox News has had lurid footage of protests in those three cities. Now, the justifications were that the city allowed CHOP, basically, and of course Seattle is one of the cities that has passed cuts to a police department budget. Now, there is absolutely nothing illegal about either of those decisions on behalf of the city of Seattle. Basically, they're decisions that Donald Trump doesn't like, and that you can tell in Barr's memo that it's to stoke fear in the base of, scary black people coming to the suburbs. But, there were no legal citations at all in Barr's memo. And you know that it's going to get thrown out by the courts, up to and probably including the Supreme Court, as soon as it gets challenged. And there are several lawsuits in the work challenging that memo. It basically was a campaign document, and the Justice Department has become an instrument of Donald Trump's TV viewing habits, which is really pretty frightening, honestly. That happened. And then on Wednesday, we got a decision in the Breonna Taylor case. That was the case in, March 13th in Louisville, where, a mistaken drug raid, the boyfriend of Breonna Taylor opened fire at police who did not identify themselves and barged into their, home with a no-knock warrant. They opened fire. Three policemen opened fire. They did not hit the boyfriend, but they did strike and kill Breonna Taylor as she was getting out of bed to, again, try and defend against what they thought were home invaders. Private home invaders, I should say.
Apparently Taylor had an ex-boyfriend who was involved in drug dealing, and her current boyfriend at that time, Walker, the man she was with, a man named Walker, he had a weapon with him because he knew that her ex-boyfriend had been harassing her. So there's every indication he might have thought that the people breaking into their home was her ex-boyfriend and some of his buddies. Her boyfriend at the time, Walker, did fire one shot and did fire the first shot, but then the police opened fire and it was something like 32 rounds were fired.
And the only
by the police.
Yes, and the of the three officers who opened fire, the shot that killed Taylor was from an officer who was not charged at all. Yeah. Only one officer was charged, and they were charged with basically being reckless
shooting,
endangerment.
I think that was the officer that shot through a window that was covered by a window blind, and that is pretty reckless, no line of sight or anything.
He had three counts of reckless endangerment, one for each of the other apartments that he shot into that were not even Taylor's apartments. They were neighbors.
Mm-hmm.
He was not charged, of course, for the shots that he did fire into Taylor's apartment, if any. So basically the message of this is if you're going to open fire at somebody in their bed, it's okay if you strike them, but you have to shoot accurately. It's a hell of a message to send. And of course there were major demonstrations in Louisville this week, at which LMPD was arresting journalists as well as protesters for no apparent reason. There were demonstrations all over the country because of this decision, and it was really pretty discouraging. The Kentucky Attorney General who led the investigation and announced the decision, a man named Cameron, he is a protege of Mitch McConnell. And, I think the fear was that his decision was timed and calibrated as such to help McConnell's reelection campaign by you know, stoking demonstrations in Louisville. Of course, most of Kentucky is fairly rural, and that's the base of McConnell's support. So you can point to the big city and say, here again are all these scary black people. You need Mitch McConnell in office to protect us from them, which is very resonant with Donald Trump's campaign message. These are very large, dynamics in play here, and they really do point toward, non-democratic norms, as being at stake in the election this year, both in the Senate races and in the presidential race.
And speaking of the presidential
race, I should mention something else about the Louisville protests, which is that a notorious private contractor named Tiger Swan. It basically is this generation's Blackwater. It's a private security firm that is usually hired by the federal government, usually tasked with infiltrating protest movements. They were spotted in Louisville last night. And if they are in Louisville, chances are very good they're in Portland, and chances are very good that they're in Seattle. So people in the protest movement here should be on the lookout for private infiltrators and provocateurs, because it looks like the federal government is in the business of trying to provoke that. They were at Standing Rock, by the way. So people who had experience with Standing Rock knows exactly who that firm is.
Yeah.
All right. There is a debate coming up this Tuesday.
The first debate between Donald Trump and Joe Biden will be this coming Tuesday at 6 p.m. Pacific time. That's going to be, it's going to be moderated by Chris Wallace, who anchors Fox News Sunday. It'll be held at Case Western Reserve University with social distancing, I assume, and probably no audience. Wallace is going to draft his own questions for the candidates, but he did release a list of topics.
And Wallace, we should say, is one of the few people at Fox News who actually has some journalistic integrity.
Yeah.
He's pretty good.
Yeah, the list of topics he announced, though, kind of point directly to Donald Trump's and Republican talking points. So first off, he's going to ask about the Trump and Biden records and backgrounds. Then he's going to ask them about the Supreme Court. He's going to ask about COVID-19, the economy, and then race and violence in our cities. And just notice the framing here around that topic. There's no mention of police violence, of course, no mention of racial bias in policing. It's all about race and violence in our cities, which is Donald Trump's talking point. And then the final topic is the integrity of the election. Again, something that's generally not in question around the nation, unless you're a very far right-wing fanatic like Donald Trump, who is trying to ensure that the election won't be fair. So it'll be interesting to see how Wallace frames the questions, particularly on those last two topics of quote unquote race and violence in our cities and the integrity of the election. Now, it'll also be an interesting, and I should mention too that Donald Trump is not a fan of Chris Wallace. He has criticized him a lot on Twitter. So we'll also see if Chris Wallace is a little more pointed in his questioning of Trump than we might otherwise expect from a Fox News personality.
And Wallace has actually, he has had interviews with Trump in the past where he has really pressed Trump on some of these points. So that's one of the reasons why Trump is not a fan of him, because Wallace has asked him tough questions in the past.
Yeah.
And that's a no-no for Donald Trump.
Yeah. So it'll also be an opportunity to assess Joe Biden's cognitive function. Although at this point, I have to say I have very little patience with people who say, oh, Joe Biden, I can't vote for him because he's not perfect. I have to say, I think at this point, I'd probably vote for a houseplant to, replace Donald Trump.
Yeah,
I don't think it matters.
And I think there's a very simple answer to people who, for example, I mean, I'm not a fan of Joe Biden. I've been criticizing him for decades.
Oh, yeah.
He was terrible in the Senate. But I have confidence that if Joe Biden is president, there will be an election in 2024, and it will have opposition figures on the ballot. I don't have any such confidence of that with Donald Trump.
And that it will be reasonably fair.
Yeah, if you want to organize for better elected officials, including better choices for president in 2024, you really don't have any choice but to vote for Joe Biden this time, because I don't think you will have that option. I don't think we will be free to have dissent in this country with a second Trump term, or a third Trump term, or a fourth Trump term.
Yeah, and just look at the people beneath Trump. I mean, he's been hiring these cronies who are as corrupt and as unqualified as him. And I don't think you would get that with Joe Biden. You know,
no,
I think you would get people who maybe they're not perfect, but at least they know how to do the job.
And at least they're not in that job primarily to enrich themselves in the
family. Yeah. And they might be, but that's not the primary thing, you know.
Yeah.
They're there to actually do the job, you know, which is not what you're getting at all with the Trump cronies. So.
And as much as Trump wants to tie Biden to the two Obama terms, there were 8 years of Obama without any real scandals or corruption at all.
Yeah.
Period. Obama ran a remarkably clean presidency.
Yeah, so bring me back to that, and I'll be happy.
Yeah.
I mean, I will be happy to criticize Joe Biden and the things he doesn't do right, but I'll be much, much happier.
I'll be much, much happier
if we at least have this corrupt guy out of office, Donald Trump.
Yep. Yeah, so we'll get to that when we get to our ballot analysis next month, but the debate is going to be very interesting.
All right. Also, development this week regarding the 2020 census.
Yeah, a U.S. District Judge Lucy Koh ruled on Thursday that the U.S. Census will not be ended a month early. Excuse me, as Donald Trump had ordered. She ruled that the Trump administration had failed in its duty to provide an accurate census count, and that the administration did not give an adequate reason for ending the count a month early. Before COVID-19 struck, the census was due to be finished by July 31st. But once people went into lockdown, the Census Bureau decided to extend the deadline to the end of October. But Trump administration attorneys began to argue then that the deadline had to be moved up to September 30th so that the Census Bureau could meet a second deadline of December 31st to deliver population counts, which will be used to apportion the number of House congressional seats for each state. But Judge Koh ruled that the Commerce Department, headed by Trump loyalist Wilbur Ross, had put pressure on the Census Bureau to stop it from asking Congress for an extension of the December 31st deadline. So Koh ruled that the December 31st deadline was arbitrary and could be extended, and that she would extend it to April 30th, 2021. So that
now,
the census could
be
finished on October 31st.
The actual reason why the Trump administration wanted the census to wrap up and deliver its report to the Treasury Department was that if it's delivered to the White House by December 31st, that gives Trump time to certify the results as accurate before he leaves office, if he does. So,
and ending the census early means that ending the census early means that certain people won't be counted. And those people include homeless people, who are hard to find. And the census takers need an extra month in order to find those folks. People who are not fluent in English, who may have been missed in the first pass of census taking, and seasonal workers during the summer, like construction workers and agricultural workers who move around a lot and are hard to locate, but are easier to find in October when they've settled down.
And I want to underscore the homelessness part of that. I have a friend who is a supervisor for the Census Bureau's effort here in Seattle, and they had already started moving people to other parts of the country that needed, field workers more. They basically gave up on trying to enumerate homeless people here in King County, because they were scrambling to meet that Trump administration deadline and determined that there were more people uncounted counted in other parts of the country. So it had a very real impact on marginalized communities.
Yeah, the extra month to October 31st will have a very real impact on counting those folks that were very hard to count. And that Judge Koh recognized that, and that informed her ruling. So it was a very good ruling, and it's very good news. It would be great if the census could have been extended through the end of the year, but October 31st, an additional month, is awesome.
Yeah, it will help a lot.
And we are out of time. All right, so we'll talk to you both next week.
We will be back.